So, my assessment of financial markets is that they are absolutely hostage to low interest rates and added liquidity. And my assessment of the economy is it's weaker than the data would suggest. And underlying some of the strong headline numbers is a real deterioration in conditions that won't make itself readily apparent until it's probably too late. So I think we're at a very dangerous point here. And
Welcome to Thoughtful Money. I'm its founder and your host, Adam Taggart. According to the official data, be it economic growth, disinflation, or jobs, things could hardly be better. But if you talk to a regular person on the street, they're likely to tell you that times aren't that great and getting tougher. Why is the prevailing narrative so disconnected from the reality on the ground? And where are things likely to head from here? To tackle this conundrum, we're fortunate to welcome macro analyst and interviewer extraordinaire, Grant Williams, to the program. Grant, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, Adam. Always good to see you, my friend. How are you?
I'm good, my friend. Have just survived California storms. As you said, it's always great to see you. We got to, our paths crossed for like a microsecond in Vancouver
very briefly
last
very
week.
Briefly,
So
yeah,
I'm
too
glad
briefly.
we've got the time here to sit down and really catch up. Lots and lots of questions for you, Grant. And I know you're a guy who cares about the regular guy too. So, that conundrum I mentioned there in the intro, I'm really looking forward to getting your opinion on. But if we can, let's start at the very high level question I like to ask you at the beginning of all of our talks. What's your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets?
Yeah, here's a broad question. Well, it's funny, Adam, what you just said there at the top, I think is perhaps the thing to zero in on, and that's this disconnect between the economic data and how people in the street are feeling. And I think there's some very important information in that. And we've seen recently, a slew of good results. A slew of good, strong economic data. And we've seen the market sell off on the back of it. And we've seen, poor data, and we've seen the market rally. And, you find yourself reading headlines in things like the Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, serious publications, serious financial publications of many, many years standing, along the lines of, stocks rally on poor economic data. And, stocks fall on strong jobs report, right? And this, in a nutshell, is what's happened, right? This is what's happened. There are two completely disconnected stories here. One is risk asset prices, and one is the economy as it pertains to the average American, Australian, Brit, Canadian, whatever you want to choose. What's happened over the last, I take it back to 87, and other people have different starting points when monetary policy became the be all and end all, the solution. What's the Homer Simpson's great line about beer? The cause of and solution to all of life's problems. And this is monetary policy in a nutshell. We've become conditioned to easy financial conditions, to liquidity, that famous word that everybody bandies around. And markets have become accustomed to responding to stimulus rather than economic data. And this is why you find now where people are, the market is pricing in several rate cuts this year from the Fed, despite the economy going gangbusters from all the data that you would read. The talk of soft landing has morphed into a much stronger no landing. I saw a Goldman's piece today, a printed piece of research with the number of respondents who thought that the 10-year would be trading over 5%. By the end of the year, it was 3% of respondents. That's a very, very, very low number considering where we are. So markets have become conditioned to respond to stimulus, not economic performance. And that's a real problem. It is a real problem because what people are reading in newspapers is that everything's great. Stock market hits all new all-time high. We've avoided having the crash on the front page of the newspapers, which tends to send people kind of scurry into the mattresses. So everything in the financial world is going gangbusters on the headline. I mean, we can talk about commercial real estate, and we can talk about the banking sector and stuff shortly, and I'm sure those will come up in the questions. But the markets are responding not to the economic data. They're responding to the chance that there will be more stimulus because, as we've all become conditioned to believe over the last 2 or 3 decades, stimulus equals liquidity equals higher risk asset prices, period. And so, my assessment of financial markets is that they are absolutely hostage to low interest rates and added liquidity. And my assessment of the economy is it's weaker than the data would suggest. And underlying some of the strong headline numbers is a real deterioration in conditions that won't make itself readily apparent until it's probably too late. So I think we're at a very dangerous point here. And I'm amazed you wanted me to come back on, Adam. I'm a broken record. I've advised caution for a long time now. And that caution has been warranted everywhere, but if you want all-time high stock markets, and that's
Right.
great. But if you look at the breadth, if you look at where those all-time stock markets are being posted, take a look at the S&P, take a look at the NASDAQ, take a look at the Mag 7 or the Mag 6, because Tesla is definitely not, there's nothing mag about Tesla anymore, apart from maybe the MAGA in Elon's bio. But that's where the performance is. If you look at broader, look at the Russell, look at the S&P without the big stocks, look at the NASDAQ without the big stocks, and you'll see a very different chart, which speaks to quite poor market performance.
Grant, if I can
So,
interrupt, let me just
yeah,
give some
go ahead.
percentages to what you're saying there, because I just pulled them earlier.
Sure,
So
go ahead.
over the past year, the Magnificent Seven are up 69%. The S&P is up just 20%, but
There you
still
go.
that's getting pulled up by those Magnificent Seven, right? Now the S&P is market weighted. So if we look at the equal weight S&P, that's up just 2.7%, right?
There you go.
2.7% versus 69% in the Mag 7. If you look at the Russell 2000, right, which is smaller and medium-sized businesses, over the past year, that's down 1.3%. This is the most concentrated that the S&P's top stocks have been in the past 50 years. So to your point, the breadth is just terrible.
Well, it's non-existent, right? There is no breadth. The only breadth that's there is down, right? And this is a problem because, unfortunately, a lot of people have become reliant upon CNBC for their news, upon Twitter for their news, and there's a lot of people talking about how great everything is and how everything's at all-time highs. People always talk about the market hit a new all-time high today on CNBC. There's no qualification in that, none. And so that's what people believe. So we have this very dangerous situation where asset prices are not only high but incredibly overvalued. Nvidia is the poster boy of all this stuff. And of course, we saw this back in the 2000s with Lucent and Cisco. They all have very similar charts to Nvidia, and we all know what happened then. So, people just need to be aware of this stuff, and they need to understand the context and the broader picture before they decide that just because the stock market has made another all-time high, conditions are as safe as they have been at various periods over the last couple of years. People have forgotten the meltdown we had in 20 late 22 into 2023. People have forgotten all that. It's largely been just wiped from people's memories. But real damage was done there, and the Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank crisis of this time last year, real damage was done there. And that damage has been kind of covered up and put sticking plasters over wounds that you can see the bone underneath the flesh. And it's only a matter of time before the sticking plasters come loose. And we're seeing this now with Community Bank in New York. We're starting to see that. We're seeing overseas banks in Japan and Germany that are heavily exposed to US commercial real estate having big, big falls as they release their results. So, all I'm urging people to understand is the stock market being at an all-time high is not the story. That's a headline, and it is designed very deliberately to bull animal spirits and to get people into markets. And now is not a particularly safe time to do that.
So to borrow a term from the colloquial lexicon, is it somewhat safe to say the headlines are basically fake news right now, where they're telling a story of a prosperity that really isn't a true one? It's sort of a false prosperity that we're telling ourselves, and that narrative is able to drive animal spirits and get asset prices, rollicking, but it's not something that can sustain unless we fix some of the true problems in the economy, which we'll talk about in a moment, but doesn't sound like we are.
Look, it's an interesting question. Is it fake news? I would argue that it isn't fake news. It's just a very, very selective piece of news. It's inarguable to say the stock markets are at or near all-time highs, right? It's not fake at all. They are.
That's not fake. I'm thinking more
But
of like the strong economy, the resilient consumer, the strong jobs market. There are all these things that, yes, if we take the headline number, we can say, yes, the BLS was saying that 353,000 jobs were created in January. But if we scratch below that a little bit, we realize, oh, even by some of its own methodologies, it might have actually lost over 30,000 jobs.
yeah, look, a big part of the problem here, Adam, is that there's a codependency between markets and those looking to promote them and the people reading the headlines. There's a codependency here in that the CNBCs of the world, the bulge bracket bank analysts of the world, they all want rising stock markets, right? Because that's how they make their money, and that's how CNBC get their viewers when markets are going up. But the public want to be told that. They don't want to be told bad news. They don't want to have to do the work and dig into these headlines. So, this reinforces itself until we get the, da-da-da, markets in turmoil segment coming on CNBC because things are going wrong. And then people say, well, what the hell happened? And, I've spoken about this a lot recently. There is an onus upon us, anybody who's invested in markets, to realize and understand that it's not as easy as perhaps several of the last handful of years have made it look. Things don't always just go up. And buying a ticker because you think that ticker is going higher, because someone told you that ticker's going higher, or you heard a rumor, or it's all over the Reddit boards, or whatever it is. That's not investing. It's not. It's pure speculation. And I would argue that it's idle speculation. And if you look at what's been happening, take a look at AMC. Let's look at AMC, because this is, I look at this chart of AMC, and honestly, it breaks my heart to see this, because this is the whole problem in a nutshell, right? We had AMC, we all remember the apes story and how they were sticking it to Wall Street. And, this was the way for the man in the street to stick it to the man. But we all have to hold on, diamond hands and to the moon and all these narratives around AMC. This was the reaction of a group of, and I do not mean this in a pejorative way. I mean, when I say unsophisticated investors, I mean unsophisticated in the ways of the market. They could all be brilliant people in their own fields. They could be surgeons and dentists and lawyers and doctors. I don't know. I'm talking about unsophisticated, not maybe in terms of finance, but in terms of financial markets and how they work. So you have a group of people who glom onto a narrative that is diamond hands to the moon, number go up, we're going to make a whole lot of money. And that runs smack bang into an incredibly artful and cynical CEO in the shape of Adam Aron, who took advantage of these people to issue all kinds of stock that anybody with any background in markets, any real understanding of the capital stack, of how these whole things work, was looking, calling this out and saying, what this guy is doing is shameful. And shame on him, right? And you look at the chart of AMC, take a look at a 3-year chart of AMC, and it's down, I think it's at $3 and change now, after sucking all the diamond hand guys in at the highs or thereabouts, and sucking more of them in on the way down, and persuading them all not to sell as the stock just continued to go down. It's lost about 98 or 99% of its value. And still, Adam Aron is out there, calling himself the proud silverback CEO of AMC and playing to the apes. And you know what's amazing is there will be people watching this who in the comments will attack me. I've seen it happen. I feel so bad for the people who've been screwed over by this, but they will come on still. And every time I've gone out and taken a pot shot at Adam Aron for the way he's behaved, I get the apes defending him and saying, you're a washed up has been. I mean, I just,
Well, you're challenging their
I don't,
beliefs, yeah.
well, no, but it's a shame because, ultimately when it was number go up and it was all about the number, that was all that mattered, right? It was, aha, what do you know? The stock's doubled today. When the stock's lost 99% of its value and the shareholders have been pillaged in the process, it's not about the numbers anymore. The numbers don't matter. It's about an ideal. And look, that's fine, right? That's fine to have that ideal and it's fine to passionately believe in this stuff. But one day you're going to wake up and realize what's happened. And I just feel like the people who are going to lose money in this sorry episode are the people who can likely least afford it. And I just find the whole thing such a tragedy that nothing was done about this. It was legal. What was done? Was it ethical? Was it moral? I think that's a much harder bar to clear. And you know, I just feel a great shame. But that story encapsulates a big part of the problem here, Adam. We have enticed into financial markets people who have become accustomed to things just going up and don't understand necessarily why they go up, because it hasn't mattered why they went up, right? No one asks, hey, why did I make money? People ask why did I lose money, but no one ever asks why did I make money. And so I just find it a great shame as well. Sorry to get on my soapbox and waffle on
No,
about it, but
It's,
it's
you're
something that
chopping right into the
drives me
sandbox I
mad.
wanted us to jump into, so it's great. So, I've had a number of people on this program of late, and Grant, I'm going to guess you probably have had similar on your program, where, the fundamentalists are super frustrated, right? Because the fundamentals really haven't mattered in terms of price action for a long time. They mattered briefly in 2022, but like you said, everybody's already forgotten that, right? So, because the price action has gone up for so long over the past 10 plus years or so, to your point, all that matters to people is momentum anymore, right? And so as long as price is going up, they don't care why it's going up. To them, it's just price go up means I buy more, right? And so getting back to my sort of comment about fake news, I probably should use a different term, because listening to you talk, the term that really comes to mind is magical thinking. Right, is we're telling us that, okay, because the stock market's at all-time highs, everything's great. Doesn't matter that it's concentrated into a super, small number of stocks. All the other indicators out there don't matter either. When you map that to a heavily manipulated, and when it can be, when they can get away with it, predatory environment. Right. What tends to happen here is the people who can least afford to take the damage are going out there and taking risks that they shouldn't. And Wall Street is preying on that, or just setting them up to take the fall when the whole house of cards come down. GameStop, sorry, AMC is a great example, but I think in general, this is an example of the axiom of when you're at the poker table and you can't figure out who the patsy is. It's
Right.
you, right? And I think, what right now we are just setting up to be the average, setting up the average person to be the patsy to the system here. And I say system because, yes, they're probably the least sophisticated player at the financial markets table, and they'll get fleeced probably by Wall Street because that's Wall Street's intent. But economically, they're the patsy. When this incredibly robust, economic growth that we're seeing right now, and this no landing that we're guaranteed to have, if that doesn't materialize, and you and I could talk for a long time about many of the reasons why it may not, they're the ones who are going to be losing their jobs. They're the ones who are going to be, mortally or vastly injured by what goes on here. The bigwigs, they're going to get bailed out. We can talk about the weakness of the banking system here, but no matter what happens in the story to the banking system, there's going to be rescues to make sure that the vast majority of the banks are okay, right? And their major, shareholders and bondholders are taken care of. But the average guy, he's going to be the one to bear the brunt of this. So I share your concern and your frustration about sort of where we are right here, where we're basically making the general public, the cannon fodder of what might happen going forward from here if things aren't as rosy as the headlines are trying to convince us. And you and I think have a healthy degree of skepticism about that.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. And, we live in a time of stimulus and government handouts and government largesse, but it's very difficult to target, transfer payments towards people who've lost money in the stock market, right? It's very difficult. If people can't afford to feed themselves, people on low incomes, all these kinds of things, there are ways for the government to target payments to groups of people who are suffering. But it's very difficult because a lot of the people who will lose an awful lot of money and who probably have in things like AMC were probably doing okay. They just happened to YOLO a big bunch of money into this thing and they've lost it all. They've still got jobs, they've still got decent incomes, but their savings are gone, their futures have changed, and that's very
Yeah,
difficult to make
it's
up for.
hard to. I want to just push back on that to let you
Go
address
ahead.
the rest of your answer,
Hey,
which is
sure. Push back as hard as you want, my friend.
no. But that I mean, I think that's true. But I also think a lot of the YOLOers, right, in the markets, the people that are buying the meme stocks, and the people that are buying, the lesser known cryptos and whatnot, a lot of them are younger people who have basically kind of given up
Oh, yeah.
on making the American dream through the way they've been told, right? Because they're looking at the formula and they're like, wait a minute, I'm going to work till I'm dead and I'm never going to be able to afford a house. So my only way
So
to
true.
get in is to stretch and speculate and hope I get one of the winning lottery tickets. So they're YOLOing into these things, not with discretionary play money, but like with the majority of whatever wealth they have. So if they get wiped out there, it's game over for them.
No, look, you're right. There is a huge nihilism component to all this. There really is. And you're seeing it play out in this kind of dystopian vision of the future that generation seem to have with their Vision Pro. You've seen since the Vision Pro was released, all these people. I saw a picture of two people at dinner, both with Vision Pro headsets on, eating Chinese food, and both on their phones.
Yeah,
And
it's if you
there
ever
is
seen Ready
this
Player One, it's like we're
dystopian,
stepping into that movie earlier than
right.
expected. Yeah.
Yeah, there is a dystopian aspect to this and a nihilistic aspect to this. And that, unfortunately, as you say, has been from the removal of the American dream. And I don't think people necessarily put the two together. I think people, they don't understand the fact that they can't afford a house. They don't understand why. They just think houses are unaffordable. They can't join the dots necessarily and understand why houses are so unaffordable. And that's a great shame. But here we are in an election year, 2024 in the US. We have, I mean, it's going to be Trump versus Biden unless the Democrats can find some credible way to shunt aside not just Biden, but Harris as well, without confessing to the world that the two top people in the job aren't up to scratch. It's going to be a very difficult thing for them to do. But it's going to be Trump versus Biden. Trump is an incredibly polarizing character that is absolutely going to be a problem from a fabric of society perspective if he gets elected. There are enough people that cannot countenance the idea of this man in the White House again that we're going to see an awful lot of upheaval if he wins, and I expect him to win. That's not an endorsement, that's just an assessment of the situation. And likewise, if Biden wins, I think the Republicans, given Biden's oft demonstrated cognitive difficulties, we saw the latest one this week when he saw the ghost of François Mitterrand at a NATO meeting for the G7. I mean, go figure. If he wins the vote, the Trump supporters are going to have a very, very hard time accepting that. And so, there is this undercurrent of angst in society right across the developed world. And I don't think it's any coincidence that it's happening now. You and I both know Neil Howe well, and his fourth turning framework is an incredibly important one to understand. And it's not a coincidence. This stuff is not happening now randomly. It's happening because we're at the end of a saeculum. We're at the end of the cycle where we've built something and allowed our excesses to get the better of us, and we've ruined it, and now everybody wants to tear it down. As I said to someone recently, it just so happens that we are all the age we are at the time this is happening. It's not our fault or their fault or anybody's fault. It's just the cycle of man. And all the lessons from the last fourth turning have died. All the people that held the lessons and could talk and communicate those lessons are all gone now. So we forget. And so, it's a real shame. But we have to go through this, and there is a much better world on the other side of it. But what we're going to have to go through is filled with a lot of pain, a lot of conflict, a lot of wealth destruction, a large transfers of wealth. And to some people, that's going to sound like a good idea because they feel like they don't have it. And to some people, it's going to sound like a terrible idea because they have it and they want to hang on to it. But that's just the way these things ultimately have to be resolved. And so, my message to people is always the same. Just try and understand what's happening and be prepared for it. There's not so much you can do, in all honesty, but being prepared and understanding what can happen and what's very likely to happen from this point on gives you a chance to at least think through your investments, your life, where you live, how you conduct yourself day to day. It gives you a chance to think about things before those decisions are forced upon you in the heat of some kind of horrendous moment in time.
All right. So I definitely want to get into, okay, what are some prudent ways you think folks should be preparing? But before we get there, I do have some macro questions I want to get back to. But this theme
Okay.
here is one that I've been spending a lot of time on recently in these videos because I think it is the theme, right? I think, society, it seems to be on this trajectory where a greater and greater percentage of society is beginning to give up hope, lose the script, lose faith that the system is working to its benefit. And history shows us that bad things happen when you get to a critical point where your populace basically concludes that the folks running the show aren't doing so for their greater good. We're seeing lots of breakages in the social fabric, everything from the BLM riots of a few years ago to the January 6th takeover to the explosive popularity of organic anthems like Richmond, North of Richmond, which start giving voice to the angst that the middle class is the working class is feeling. A lot of this is tied to people's feelings about their prospects. And if we end up doing a rug pull here of saying, hey, we promised you all a no landing, and then we end up into something that's a lot harsher and harder for people, a lot more people are going to start falling down into that group of angry people who are saying, hey, I've been kind of betrayed in the system here. And you mentioned Neil Howe, so I've had him on this program. We've talked about the fourth turning. I think the audience is pretty familiar with that. I've also had Peter Atwater on. Have you talked with him ever?
Yeah, Peter's a good friend. I've talked to him often. He's terrific, and I think his work that he's done on confidence has been really important, actually. Again, it's one of these things that people need to understand. It feels a little tangential, but once you get into Peter's work, you realize the applications it has are profound.
Exactly. And as people begin to lose confidence, he talks about how and begin to feel increased pressure, they have these different responses. There's sort of like a response spectrum they go down to. And it's fight or flight or freeze, which we're all familiar with. Follow, which basically is, hey, look, there's some person who's speaking to my pain here. I'm going to get behind that guy, right? And he warns about that because when societies get really desperate, that's when you kind of get like a dangerous strongman who gets elected into a position of power. And he's a great analogy where he says, look, if you're standing out in the cold rain long enough, you'll get in a car with anybody, right? So there's that worry. But then he says there's a fifth one. And to try to not get blocked from YouTube, I'll just say it's the F it response, right? Is where people just say, F this, the system's not working for me, the system is the problem. And I'm just taken to the streets and basically, upending everything. And this is where you get something like, we've seen it around the world. We've certainly seen, longstanding regimes begin to get overturned in a lot of different countries right now, usually peacefully, but we're seeing more, sort of nationalistic candidates overturning longstanding parties that have been in power for decades. Argentina being probably the latest example of one of those upsets. But on the far end of the scale, you get like what happens in Sri Lanka, where basically like the entire country just shows up at the presidential palace and drags the guy out, right? So I kind of give all this backstory to say, That appears to be the trajectory we're on. I'm not saying that the US is going to take to the streets tomorrow, but I guess my question is like, what worries me about this is I don't see a lot of things I can point to say, oh, these are developments that could reverse that trajectory. These are the developments that are going to bring more prosperity to the middle class. We're going to start building it again. We're going to bring down this, we're going to start to unwind the accelerating wealth gap. And these are the things that are going to, cool down tempers, begin to bring some equality into the system. So it's hard not to see something like a Neil Howe predicted fourth turning, where truly the status quo just breaks completely, and then eventually is replaced by something different, which is good when you're on the other side of all the turmoil, but going through it all is rough.
It is. Look, and you're absolutely right. But the thing here that people need to understand is this isn't a 2023, 2024 story. This is a process which has basically taken 85, 90 years to come to a head. And so if you read Neil's and Bill Strauss's work and you understand how these cycles unfold, you realize that all the things you're talking about are absolutely right, and the human reaction to them is consistently the same. And the outcome is always the same. It has different shades, it has different types of conflict at the end of it, for example. But these fourth turnings generally encompass financial crises. They generally encompass conflict, whether domestic or national or international. And that's just how they happen. But we live in the moment now and we say, God, how do we get here? The answer is read the last 80 years of history and you'll see. And I've talked about this story. I'll tell you a story that I've spoken about on podcast recently. So for anyone that's heard this, I apologize, but I think it's worth repeating. There's a terrific podcast in the UK called The Rest Is History. And it's two English historians. One a classical historian and one a modern historian, and each week they take a point in history and they pick it apart, and it's really well done. It's conversational, it's very light, it's not heavy, it's very accessible, but you learn an awful lot about all these different things. And they had a kind of a mini series within the podcast a year or maybe even two ago about the rise of the Nazi Party in 1920s and 1930s Germany. And I grew up post-World War II. I was, that was the history I learned. I learned it at school. I learned it through all those great war films of the 70s and 80s with, Richard Burton and Richard Harris and, Peter O'Toole and all these guys. And so I knew those stories and it's always fascinated me. And my head was always in the space of, how could this have happened? How on earth could the Germans elect Hitler? Like, how do a majority of a smart, educated, industrialized nation elect a madman? And I've always wondered that. It's always been it's like, geez, how does this happen? And over years, I've gotten to understand history more. And you go back to the Treaty of Versailles after World War I, which, the Allies were determined to cause as much pain to the Germans as they possibly could for their transgressions in World War I. And then you listen to this podcast series, and it's four, five, six episodes, each one half an hour long. And they walk you through the rise of the Nazi Party and Hitler's ascent to power and all the little milestones along the way. And at the end of that series, your mindset is, how could he not have come to power? How could this not have happened given what transpired in the lead up to it? And yet all the people that remember that, and I apologize if I'm repeating myself, but I think these are important things to understand. I explained to someone recently that I went to see my father. My father's 85 and he lives in France. He's retired and he lives in France. And I went to see him in November and I took cameras and I recorded a conversation, me and my father, the story of his life. And I sat down, like one of the interviews I do on my own channel, and I
That's
sat down with my
great.
dad. Yeah, and we talked for 3 hours, like he was a guest on one of my shows, my videos. And we just talked about his life. And I knew large parts of it, but there were parts of it I didn't know. And the only reason I did that is so that, you know, I realize I'm a grandfather now. He's a great grandfather. He's 85, and the chances are that I never met my grandfather. He died before I was born. His great grandkids have met him, and they will get to spend a period of time with him, a number of years with him. I don't know how many years that's going to be. I don't know if it's long enough to be of an age where they want to ask questions and understand that story. But when those stories go, when those stories pass away, and we don't get to hear them from people we love and we care about and who we have a natural inclination to want to hear stories from, the stories are lost from the culture. And this is why we see, you know, in the streets of Paris after the October 7th attacks in Israel, young, educated people smashing the windows of Jewish delis in broad daylight in Paris. Why? And anyone who's my age or older thinks, how the hell could this ever happen again? But of course, to be old enough to tell those stories from a cogent place where you remember that time, you're 100+ years old. So none of those kids have had their grandfathers tell them the story of what happened and the persecution of the Jews leading up to World War II and how it was smashing up and painting stars and all these heinous things that we thought we'd never have to see again. The stories are gone. And so we will repeat the same mistakes over and over again, because even though it's all there in the history books, you have to go find it. You have to want to read it and understand it, and then go looking for it and take the time to read it. And that's not the culture we've developed. We have developed this short attention span culture where I'm spoon-fed everything. I don't have to go and look for anything. I turn on my phone and TikTok or Twitter or Instagram give me everything I need. Why would I go to a library? And it
That's why I
sounds like
laugh.
I'm,
The gallows humor that you know,
yeah.
humans tend to be lazy in general. We don't want to have to do the work if we don't have
Yeah,
to,
of course we are.
but to expect a generation trained to have a TikTok extension attention span to be seeking this type of information, it's
Not going to do it.
so sadly
And
depressing.
they're not going to do it. But it, look, it's the reality. And you know, it's I'm not a boomer, just so people know. I'm a kind of early Gen Xer, but it, and it is an incredibly okay boomer thing for me to say. But it's the reality. You know, it is the reality. And we have to spend more time acknowledging the reality, and not allowing the virtual part of this to corrupt that. And that's going to be a tough lesson for an awful lot of people.
So I totally agree. I'm going to try to make what will probably be an inelegant segue here, because we're talking about something so important that's going to have so much impact on the future here. But tying back to macro for a second, so in previous generations, you would have something like when speculation got too excessive, you would have something like the tulip bubble, or the South Sea bubble, or the Great Depression, you know, the Roaring Twenties followed by the Great Depression, where it would stick in the national consciousness. Whoa, okay, we let things get really out of control there, and we're not going to do that again, right? And it takes a generation or two, to your point, where that begins to the causes of the issue fall out of the national memory, and then we start making the same mistakes again as a society, right? Now, we've had three bubbles in the course of recent memory of living generations, right? We had the dot-com bubble, and then we had the housing bubble that led up to the great financial crisis, and then we now have whatever we want to call this, the everything bubble people used to call it or whatever. But we're not learning our lesson this time. Like, even within our own generation, we just keep repeating this mistake. Why is that?
Oh, that's quite simple. I don't think that's a difficult one at all. Think back to the Wall Street crash of 1929. Just go back there and look at what happened. The stock market fell 80 plus percent. It didn't recover its highs for 25 years. 1952 or 1954 was when it finally reached its pre-October 29th heights again. We had a Great Depression. We had famine, we had all these things, and they all happened in the aftermath. We had the Roaring Twenties when times were very similar to how they are now. Then we had the Great Depression, the Wall Street crash. And so the dangers of wild speculation were hammered home to people. They saw everybody they know lose their jobs, and soup kitchens and food lines and dust bowls in the Midwest, and they saw all these things. They saw what happens when speculation gets out of hand and everybody gets sucked into it. And that scared two generations of people, both the people who went through it and suffered and got caught up in the hype and then lost everything, and their kids who watched their parents lose their jobs and have to sell the house and watch their, highly educated parents drive taxis if they could, and do all these kind of jobs, get any work at all to put food on the table. The three bubbles that you've described there, which I presume are the dot-com bubble, the 08, 07, 06, 07 market bubble, and the everything bubble today, where are the lessons, right? Where are the lessons for those? What happened was we slashed rates, we flooded the system with liquidity, we allowed debt to get massively out of hand, and we've juiced things that way. So there are no lessons. No one's been taught, don't do anything. What they've been taught is buy the dip, the Fed will rescue you. So it makes perfect sense why no one's learned their lessons these last three times, Adam, because they've been actively encouraged to buy the dip by the reactions of central banks around the world. And they've done that with both hands. They've bought every dip, and it's been a way to make money. And every now and again, something happens out of the clear blue sky. But if you've just stuck money in your IRA, look where you are. You're at all-time highs. You've been through all three of those crashes. And if you take a look at them, take a look at 08 on a chart of the S&P, considering how seismic it was to us at the time, you can just about see it on a chart of the S&P 500 now. And that's the nature of these things. Unless people see the consequences and they see the pain that these events cause to real people, they are going to believe, hey, when the stock market goes down, it's a great chance to get in. I remember in being in New York, I was working in New York when 2000 bust happened, and I vividly remember being in the line at the cafeteria at UBS in New York one lunchtime. Two guys in front of me, sliding their trays along the shelf, putting a bit of food on, and one of them said to the other something like, "Oh, did you see Lucent's down 20% today?" And the other guy literally left his tray and said, "Oh, I've got to go and buy some." Left his lunch and ran back upstairs to buy Lucent because it had dropped 20%. That's the mindset. Not why is it down 20%? Has something happened? It's price is down. I've got to go and buy some more. This could be my last chance to get in. And that's where we are. And so this is not going to change until we reach the point where the system can't be bailed out. And I would argue that given the amount of debt that's now in the system, and also given the fact that there is a very clear move on the part of multiple countries, meaningful countries around the world, to disentangle or reduce their reliance upon the US dollar, there is a clear path here to the deficits and the debt suddenly mattering a great deal because the Fed and the Treasury have got to somehow between them engineer buyers for an awful lot of debt just to keep the whole shebang rolling along. And I think we are getting closer and closer to the point in time where it's just not going to be possible.
All right. Well, you're such a great interviewer, Grant. You intuited where I wanted to take this, which is, earlier you were talking about how we have a system that's become addicted to liquidity, and it's been this practice of just flooding the system with liquidity when anything starts to go wrong, which has prevented us from taking our full lumps, from paying the full price of our speculation. So we're not learning that lesson. We just keep leaning into, this, what I hear you saying is an unsustainable system. So yes, it raises the question, well, how much longer can this last for? I hear you saying nobody knows for sure, but maybe we're entering the later innings of it, and we're certainly beginning to see some pretty big developments on the world stage to that are going to make it harder for the U.S. to keep getting away from business as usual. So I guess two questions for you. One is, without knowing how long it's going to take, do you have a gut feel of the timeline here? Are we still talking years, decade or two out, or do you think it's something that could be more acute? And then secondly, if in your answer you can address in this next year, let's say, we've had a debate on whether the lag effect is actually going to matter or not, the lag effect from all the rate hikes that the Fed has done from starting quantitative tightening. we've had a higher for longer campaign. Now the Fed's talking like it's going to start to bring it down, but it's not planning to drop it precipitously. Whether it's forced to or not later on, different story. But there's a lot of people out there that are saying at some point the lag effect's going to matter. And then there are other people who are saying, nope, liquidity has been the game. They'll just flood even more liquidity in the system, and we're going to be able to engineer something that feels like a soft landing. So how long can the whole enchilada hold up here? Like, when do you think the wheels really start coming off? But even this year itself, will we start to see some issues with just push out more liquidity and everything's going to be fine story?
Well, there's a couple of ways to answer that. First of all, we know that's what they'll do because that's really the only tool they have. So there will be liquidity poured into this to try and keep it together. But I would say let's go back to 2008 and the TARP. Let's talk about the TARP. $787 billion, right? Which sounds like peanuts today. But it was a huge sum back then. Everybody was just blown away by the size of this stimulus package, this rescue package. And when they announced that and they announced what they were going to do, the vast majority of commentators, analysts, economists, everybody said, this is nuts, we're going to get inflation. There's no way that this works without significant inflation. And that was everybody's fear. And I was absolutely among those. And of course, what people mean by that is we're going to see the CPI go up. We're going to see, food prices go up and electricity bills go up and all these things. We're going to see all that. It's a catastrophic plan. And it didn't happen. It didn't happen. We saw massive asset price inflation, massive asset price inflation right across the spectrum. But that's not something that the man in the street is faced with every time he goes to buy milk. So it didn't really matter. And because the CPI stayed benign, the mission accomplished banner could be dusted off and hung once again. And everybody who was calling for inflation was made to eat crow. Now, fast forward to 2020, 2021, we have another round of massive stimulus in the wake of COVID, more direct than it had been before. But it was added to the amount of liquidity in the system. And hey, presto, here comes inflation. And it spikes to double digits in many developed economies. I think it only quite got to double digits in the US, but got close. And suddenly there's pandemonium and panic and what the hell's going on? And we need to deal with this. And this is a nightmare. And Fed policy changes and they're forced to tighten, yada, yada, yada. And it's like, I don't know if you've ever made, have you ever made custard? I know Americans aren't big on custard. They have the frozen dessert. But in England, we have custard with our apple pie instead of ice cream. And it's, you know what custard is. But to make it from scratch with custard powder, at least, instead of making it from real scratch, you pour custard powder in, you put hot milk in, and you stir it. And you keep stirring, you keep stirring, you keep stirring. And it takes a while before anything happens. It just doesn't thicken. You just keep stirring this damn stuff. And the temptation is to pour more custard powder in. You just keep, and I know this because my dad made me custard. And if you listen to this, Dad, hashtag never forget custard gate. He was left alone to look after the kids one time, and this was what happened. And he just kept pouring custard powder into this thing, and kept pouring it in, and eventually, the whisk just got stuck. It wouldn't move, and it happened really quick. Suddenly, it just quit. And that's what happens, right? All the stimulus goes into the markets, into economies, and suddenly it matters. And because of the nature of the COVID stimulus, it was a direct injection into consumers' pockets. That was the fire that lit the spark. And so when we think about all this stuff, we think about what's been happening, and people talk about when the debt's going to matter. It doesn't matter until it does. And when we talk about this move away from the dollar, it also doesn't matter until it does. And people, Brent Johnson and Luke Gromham are two very dear friends of mine. I love them both. And contrary to popular belief, they do love each other. But they've got this back and forth on Twitter, which is just so much fun to watch because they're two incredibly well-argued and thoughtful cases on either side of a really important debate. I think Brent is absolutely right in what he says about the milkshake and the dollar. And I think Luke is absolutely right. And people struggle to hold those two things in their heads at the same time because both of them is always a counter to the other one. But it's just a question of timing. And so when people talk about, oh, people are trying to bypass the dollar, they're absolutely right. And Brent will come back and say, yeah, but it doesn't make any difference. It's tiny. It doesn't actually matter. And he's absolutely right. And look, these countries have just released more dollar debt. And he's absolutely right. And Luke will say, yeah, but this is happening over here. And he's absolutely right. The point to understand here is the direction of travel has changed. And just like making the custard, we are now in a world where people are actively and publicly looking to be less reliant upon the dollar. They're not saying we're going to ditch the dollar, but we are actively looking for alternatives to it because, A, we feel that there's too many of them, and the American economy and the American finances are in tatters, which they are. They've been for a long time, but it's just getting worse. And B, the US Treasury have weaponized the dollar. The SWIFT system was weaponized long ago, so that was a big red flag. But once they froze those Russian central bank assets, that is something you cannot ignore as a sovereign entity who holds US dollar reserves. You cannot have your national foreign exchange reserves at the whim of a government, whoever they may be, friend or foe. So the direction of travel has changed and it is set now. And so we are going to carry on down that road. People are not going to have a come to Jesus moment where they go, actually, phew, the war in Ukraine's ended. We don't need to worry about having our reserves frozen anymore. Those days are gone. So at what point does that matter when people continually look for ways to move away from the dollar? I don't know. I don't know. But there is a point out there where it matters because every single barrel of oil that is traded in dirhams or euros or real is $100 less debt that's been bought by a foreign sovereign. And Luke, I just recorded a podcast with Luke and he had a terrific stat for me, which I hadn't seen. He talked about the US debt. It's gone from 17 trillion to 34 trillion in the last decade. So we've had 17 trillion added on that. And people look at a
Doubled
chart of
in a decade.
it's doubled, right? In a decade, after taking 240 years to get to 17 trillion, right? People look at this and go, well, they look at China as the chart of Chinese holdings of treasuries, or they look at the Japanese chart of holdings, they look at the Russian chart of treasury holdings, and they go, oh, well, the Japanese are selling. And someone will say, well, look, there's a lot going into the Cayman Islands, which is all hedge funds, or Brussels, or there are other buyers, blah, blah, blah. And that's fine. You can argue the toss over any chart you like. But Luke pulled out a great stat. He said, in that 10 years, total holdings by all foreign central banks has gone down $10 billion. Now, if you think about that, you think about what that means, it's truly extraordinary. We've added $17 trillion of debt to the US pile, and foreign central banks, who have always been the biggest and most consistent buyers of that debt, over that time have net sold.
Sold.
And it's marginal, and people are going, oh, it matters, right? And it may not matter. There's a treasury market fail, or there's an auction that fail. It may not matter right now because at the moment they are covering that 17 trillion from other paper. And we all know who the biggest buyer of that is, of course, it's the Federal Reserve. But it matters. And so the fact that the incentives have changed, the fact that foreign central banks are incentivized to find alternatives to the dollar now, it's not just a kind of thing we feel like doing. We need to secure our national security and we need to secure those reserves and make sure that we will always have control. Remember, this is why for the last 2 years, central bank purchases of gold have gone to levels they've never been seen in records going back 70, 80 years, because gold is a completely neutral reserve asset. So the world is changing. And we don't do well with change as human beings. We don't handle it well. We don't see it when it's big and slow moving. We tend to react to change when it's in our face or impacts us personally and directly. But these are massive changes in a financial system in which we all swim. And, you know, my friend Ben Hunt wrote this great piece years ago about, you know, about water, and told the story of two goldfish swimming towards an old goldfish, two young goldfish. And the old fella says to one of the goldfish, "Hey, water's nice today, boys, huh?" And one of the goldfish says, "What's water?" We don't realize we're swimming in this stuff because it doesn't actually impact us. But if you join the dots, if you pay attention to moves being made that seem innocuous by foreign governments, in terms of their reserve holdings, asset allocation, gold purchases, there's a very clear set of dots here that you can follow. And it leads in one direction and one direction only. Less demand for the dollar, more pressure on the Fed to cover the deficit in terms of the deficit of demand for treasuries, and the likelihood that the pressure on interest rates is going to be upward if they are going to try and sell those bonds. And it doesn't
Right.
matter till it matters, but it will matter.
All right. Well, look, sadly, we're coming up on the hour here. I could talk with you for hours, Grant, and just want you to know on the new Thoughtful Money platform, you're welcome to come here anytime you like. Open invitation. Okay, so there's a lot in what you just talked about there that we as individuals don't have agency over, right? We can't really control what foreign central banks are going to do with their treasury purchases or what trade deals they're going to strike. But we don't have to just sleepwalk into whatever may be coming in the future here. We have personal agency. And earlier you talked about the importance of getting knowledgeable about sort of the true nature of what's going on and then taking steps to reduce our own personal vulnerability to what might be coming down the road. And who knows, maybe even opportunities to profit, right? So what are some prudent preparations that you would encourage people to consider? I'll put one out there just because you've already sort of put it on the table. Perhaps getting at least some exposure to gold. Take a page from those central bank playbooks that are saying, "Hey, this is a currency unit we can all trust," might be a good step for people.
Yeah, and you know, I've been an advocate of gold for many, many years,
A
and
long
my
time.
you know my allocation to it rises and falls depending on the conditions. And right now, I think your allocation to it should be rising, but there are other things that people can do. It's not as daunting, and a lot of those are kind of mindset things. You know, first of all, I think reading history is so important. You know, market history, but also now geopolitical history. You know, there are so many wonderful books, wonderful podcasts out there. It's so accessible now to immerse yourself in history. And even if it's, you know, there's another great series called Empire, which someone put me onto recently, which is another podcast series. And they go through, you know, the English Raj in India and the Roman Empire and the Ottoman Empire and all these empires. And the story of empire is the story of America. You know, America is an empire, and its story will be similar in nature to all the other empires because we're all humans and we all make the same mistakes. So I think it's important to understand history to realize that these previously unthinkable events happen a lot over time. And then another thing I think is important, Adam, is your mindset. You know, and again, I've spoken about this recently. We've become conditioned to think about buying stocks. And the idea that, oh, I'm going to buy that stock is a very particular mindset. And it's a very different mindset to, I'm going to invest in this business. And we've substituted the latter for the former over the years. And I understand it. You know, it's way better for all the, you know, the Charles Schwabs of the world and the CNBCs of the world to get you thinking in terms of buying a stock. Because buying a stock is just, there's a three-letter ticker that I've been given a tip to own, and I'm going to buy it. Why? Because it's going to go up and I'm going to make money. And the simple truth is, when you become a shareholder in a company, you're a part owner of that business. And thinking of it in terms of ownership, in terms of, do I want to own this business, is a very, very different mindset And whilst it's been okay to just buy stocks because they've gone up, when we get to the inevitable bursting of these bubbles, you are going to find that stocks go down as well as up. And the ones that go down the least and the ones that perform the best are the good businesses. So, if people can just change their mindset when they get a tip, and instead of going, hey, you should buy this stock, just try and think to yourself, hey, do I want to invest in this business? Is this a business I want to invest in? If this was not listed, if there was not a three-letter ticker for this stock that I could just press a couple of buttons in my E-Trade account and buy the stock, would I put my capital with the owners of this business and expect to see a return, expect to see a yield, expect to see growth in that business? It's a very different mindset, and it requires, as I've said before, more work on our part. We're going to all have to work harder, and there's no substitute for hard work.
I totally agree with that. And it's interesting with this mindset of buying a stock, it's very transactive. It's very,
Yes.
very sort of like, oh, I think it's underpriced. I think it's going to go higher. And if it does, let's say your thesis is right, then you have to ask yourself, okay, well then do I get out now? Because is that arbitrage gone, and is it now too overpriced, right? And it's just this constant treadmill of transactions that you have to be more right than wrong on over time to grow your wealth, which, to be honest, most average people, they don't have the skill set, the expertise, or the bandwidth to do that, right? Whereas if you put in the effort to invest in a business, you're much more likely, if you're making a good decision, to pick a good business and ride it for a long period of time. And therefore, your attention and your churn and your transaction volume will probably be a lot lower. In the long run, you'll do less work, right? Because you're hopefully just
Right.
accumulating good businesses. And in large part, holding them until they don't become good businesses anymore. And I think history shows that that tends to be a much better, a much more higher probability path to success if you build a portfolio of really good businesses and then hold on to them. But that's not the mindset that we're being encouraged to develop by today's environment.
No, we've become focused on price, and it's very different to value. Again, I'm repeating myself, but price is what you pay for something, value is what it's worth, and they're different, and they tend to be different most of the time. Things are either expensive, i.e. they're trading, they're overvalued, or they're cheap, they're undervalued. They're not, people that haven't recognized the value in them. But we've become fixated on price. It's all that matters to people. Hey, what price is it? Never mind, Nvidia, what price is Nvidia today? Not what's that business worth? What's the value of Nvidia? Is it 100 times sales or whatever god-awful metric it's got to? I would argue, no, it isn't. But that doesn't mean the price isn't right for now. But if we can condition ourselves to think first about value and not price, I think it will give you a much better chance of owning investments in businesses that will weather storms better when the inevitable storms come.
All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing all that wisdom with us, Grant. As we wrap up here, two last questions for you. One is for folks that have really enjoyed this discussion and would like to follow you and your work, where should they go?
Well, both of you should find me at grant-williams.com. The two people who've enjoyed this,
That's
Dad,
not
I know
true.
one of them's you. I'm not sure who that is with you, but give him my love. And yeah, it's all there. I'm on Twitter at TTMYGH, and everything else is grant-williams.com. Very simple.
All right, fantastic. And when I edit this, Grant, I'll put those URLs up on the screen so folks know exactly where to go. Folks, I'll have links in the description below the video too, so you can get one-click access to them. And you may have already answered my second question, Grant. I'll leave it up to you. But I've been closing these discussions recently by asking our guests to share one non-money related investment that they would encourage folks to consider adopting in their lives, because we've been talking about money and finances for this whole past hour. Now you did talk about reading market and geopolitical history. You gave us two great podcasts to go listen to, The Rest of the Story and Empire. And then we talked a bit about mindset. But is there anything else that you might want to add into that non-monetary bucket?
Well, the rest is history, just so you get the right name of the podcast for
Oh,
anyone listening. The rest is history, so that's
sorry,
okay.
the rest is history.
Yeah, I just want to make sure everyone gets the right thing. Yeah, the other thing I would say, and it goes back to what I did with my own father, spend time talking to people of different generations, older generations of you, about their lives. I mean, it's fascinating, they lived in a completely different world to the one we live in. in every possible way. It's remarkable. And so listening to those stories and spending time with people while they're still around, and getting to hear their experiences in their own language, in their own voice, firsthand about how their lives were. You'll be amazed once you get your grandparents talking about what life was like in the 1950s. You will be amazed at how fascinating it is to you, this completely different world that you're not familiar with. It's extraordinary. And so spend time hearing the stories of people who lived in a different world, and listen to them and take them in, and cherish that time, because the people and the stories will be gone one day, and you won't have the chance to ask these questions and listen to these stories. And that's, I find, to be an incredible shame.
So I'm very both impressed and envious of your decision to sit down and interview your father the way that you did, Grant, because I have the same ability to do that, technology-wise, except both my parents passed away in the past 12 months. And right. Having now, you know, in the aftermath, been going through their personal effects or whatnot, and coming up with all sorts of questions that I just wished I could go back and ask them right now. Yeah. It's gone. Like you said, once they're gone, that opportunity is gone for good. So you can't underscore enough the value of what you're saying there, which is, to the extent that you've got stories you want to preserve, wisdom you want to tap into, or even just conversations you want to have that you've been meaning to have, you'd like to have, I'll get around to it sometime. You know, once folks are up in their, certainly in their 80s, you know, don't wait, just have them.
Agreed.
All right. Well, thanks very much, my friend. This has been wonderful. Like I said, you're welcome back on the program anytime. Really appreciate it, Grant. Always great to see you.
Mate, as always, I'm delighted that Thoughtful Money is going so well. Kudos to you. You know, you do a fantastic job, and I'm so pleased people are giving you the love that you deserve for this product, because it's always superb. So more power to you, my friend. I hope it continues to blaze a trail for you.
You're very kind, my friend. I consider myself a very thin shadow of the excellent standard that you set, but I really appreciate the kind words.
All right, mate. Take care of yourself. We'll talk soon.
Well, all right. Well, now's the time in the program where we bring in the lead partners from New Harbor Financial, one of the financial advisory firms endorsed by Thoughtful Money. I'm joined this week by senior partner Mike Preston. John Lodra has the week off. Mike, how you doing?
Good, Adam. How are you? Good to see you.
I'm good. Hey, it's always great to see Grant. I'm sure you took a bunch of notes. What were some of your top takeaways from that conversation?
You know, Grant talked a lot about, you know, the markets responding to, instead of economic performance, they respond to stimulus now. It's absolutely right. It's the subject of the Fed is a very tired subject. That's really all almost anyone talks about anymore. And game theorizing, what the market's going to do in response to what the Fed does. Well, we really kind of went on a one-way trip starting back in the financial crisis in my mind in 2008 or 2009. The system basically broke back then, fell under its own weight, and the rules were completely changed. And the rules were not changed in a good way, I don't think. I'd like to paraphrase some of the things that I heard Grant say that I thought were very clear, very poignant, and very, very, it's good to realize just how warped and how unreal this time is that we're living through. And Grant talked about the fact that he's a broken record. He's been a broken record for a lot of years. He's been advising caution. Well, so have we. I don't think that either one of us can be blamed, though. The rules have completely changed, and valuation metrics haven't worked. We can show you, we can prove, and others have done the same. We've quoted John Hussman's work many times on this channel. Valuation metrics are absolutely, completely unglued from reality, and there's no way for markets to produce solid results from these levels. The problem is that momentum keeps carrying things higher and higher, and this is all about psychology. You know, Grant said the stock market at all-time highs is not the real story. This is to entice people into the markets. This whole wealth effect, which frankly is a crime in my opinion, but this whole thing is about getting people to feel like they're left out, that they're not in the pool. They want to jump in the pool. They want to be part of the party. It's really completely, it's almost insane what we've lived through here. And he talked about AMC, which is, you know, the movie company, and then GameStop, these meme stocks. That was back in 2020. That was back when COVID started. And then we had $7 trillion in stimulus. And we just keep rolling forward in this new normal. Grant talked about the fourth turning. I I too am a big fan of the fourth turning theory, Strauss and Howe's work on that. And I think that we're in the culmination phase, or the climax of the fourth turning. And I think in the next 5 years, we're going to see that climax. And so I don't think it's going to be any surprise to any of us when we look back and see just how unreal all of this was. A lot of what we're seeing here in the financial markets is not real. Feels real because today it's real, but you can't really have two big bubbles, and we're in the third, but two big bubbles within the last 25 years have collapsed by two-thirds or more, and we're in the third and largest bubble here. And while we can't predict what is going to happen in the future, this market should fall by 60 plus percent just to get back to fair value. So that's the hard thing. We're forced to have this faith in the numbers and in math, which we do have, or faith in money printing, faith in the new normal. We choose faith in mathematics and faith in history. Grant talked about read history, talk to your elders. Absolutely. If we don't understand history, we're going to keep repeating the same problems over and over again. I love talking to older people, always ask them about their experiences in life. And I think we can learn from that. Problem with the reality of what happens in economic cycles, though, and even with the fourth turning theory, is that you only see the completion of the cycle every 80 years or so. That's kind of central to the whole theory, is that most people have to be gone before you can start all over again. World War II was so horrific, that was the last fourth turning, that all of those people have to be gone before it's possible to enter into that climax again. So there's so much more here we can talk about. Grant talks a lot about the fact that we have this great wealth disparity. We've been going on about that for many years. A lot of people see it. It just hasn't mattered yet, because the average person, if they're not feeling the pain, they're not going to do anything about it. And I believe the average person feels that things are not real anymore. They feel like they're, part of what they're witnessing with an explosion in housing prices and an explosion in the stock market. Kind of feels good to be part of that. It's good if you own a house. It's really bad if you don't own a house. But people don't really understand why it's that way. Grant said they understand that they can't afford a house, many people, but they don't understand why. And it's not until this whole thing comes unglued and confidence in the money printing and the Fed is lost that we really understand the cost of this. And it sounds like I'm on the soapbox here too, because we've said this for many years and we've been really early, just like Grant. But everything that we do in managing money, I'm happy to go into some of the things we're doing lately if you'd like as well, but everything that we do about managing money keeps those big picture things in mind, and we're constantly trying to be very cautious, but also participate when we can, and just realize that this is probably short-lived.
Well, and that's exactly where I want to take this, which is you talked about kind of putting your faith in math and reality, and to a certain extent, even though you didn't use the word, Mike, fundamentals. And I talked about earlier with Grant that one of the challenges and frustrations for a lot of fundamentalists is the fundamentals haven't really mattered much in terms of price action for a long time. And so if you're a capital manager like you are, right? I mean, you are managing your clients' assets, and I was just looking at some data around thoughtful money, and it reaffirmed an understanding I already had, which is that like two-thirds of the audience that watches these videos is 45 years old or older, right? So these are people who are, in the second half of their lives. In many cases, they've made a good chunk of their wealth, and they don't want to lose it, and they don't have time to recover from a really big loss, right? So they want to continue to grow their wealth, but they, more importantly, they don't want to lose what they've accumulated up to today. So we have this market where I feel guys like you have a really, you've got a really sacred responsibility, but a really tough job, right? Which is you have to manage capital in this crazy environment where you distrust the current price action. Right. So you think that there will be some correction at some point in time where the fundamentals will matter more, and that'll get expressed in true price discovery. But at the same time, we live in a world where the interventionists are going to keep intervening. Right. So a lot of the folks that I interview on this channel, they kind of think the arc from here over the next year-ish or so is going to be The current market rally, melt up, you could even call it right now, is going to hit some zenith. And then things are going to start to get rocky. And if they get rocky enough, or when they get rocky enough, then we're going to see the central planners step back in with another massive policy response. And that's probably going to shoot assets to the moon again. So even though you believe in math, you just can't take a math-based position and then just hold on to it forever. You've got to be really aware of and cognizant of what's likely to happen with the non-market participants who are coming in to juice things up. That's a real challenge, but your reality is not managing the markets you wish you had. Your reality is managing the markets as they are today. So how are you as a capital manager dealing with this? You know, I think prices are going to need to correct at some point, but then again, if they do, the central planners, the powers are going to step in and try to juice things again if they can. How are you currently navigating that landscape?
It's really a hard job, Adam. Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's difficult because this time that we're living through is not a normal time. As I said before, three major bubbles of this magnitude within 25 years. I can't find anywhere in U.S. history that that's happened before. You know, and now we have an all-in situation where probably the entire thing blows up if we have a reset in asset prices. I know that you recently had an interview, I believe, with Sven Henrik, who basically said that very thing, yeah, who said the whole system depends upon it not going down anymore. So they have to do this. And they don't have any other plan. They don't have any other lever to throw. It's one thing and one thing only, confidence. So it's difficult because I know, based on these valuations and based on these fundamentals, that the S&P 500 should fall by two-thirds from here, maybe more. Furthermore, I know that over 5 to 10 to 15 years from these levels, the expectation or the net expectation from these levels is a negative return. You know, Treasury bills should far outperform the S&P from these levels. What I did underestimate is just how far this can go. Right. So, you know, thank goodness for clients. We've never shorted the market net. We've never really bet on the market going down, but we have raised cash and had some caution for a bunch of years that looking back, maybe I wish that we didn't, because here we are today on the S&P. It just touched 4,995 points. It's just about to touch 5,000 as we speak. And so we're at the all-time top. And so the best thing to have done as we speak right now is to just go into the S&P 500 index and stay there. But that's not the end of the story, particularly if I'm right and the S&P falls by two-thirds or more. So that's the difficult spot that we're put in as a money manager. And it's all about psychology. So I talk here a lot about fundamentals, but I would say 70 to 80% of what I do is about psychology. It's about helping people understand that they have enough, that they don't need to change the market, they don't need to chase the market. It's about picking a side, whether you're going to jump into the pool or you're going to be more restrained and be okay with it if you're left out. It's about feeling comfortable with your position, and you know, frankly, it's about simplifying life and having the okay to do that. And lastly, it's probably about deflecting or assigning kind of the emotional turmoil for a lot of people that hire us from themselves to us. So all we can do is look at the data and take actions based on the data and pick a side to some extent and have some conviction about it. But that doesn't mean we're doing nothing. That doesn't mean that we're sitting on our hands and doing nothing. We're close to 40% net long stocks. As we speak, we're making some adjustments on our hedges. We're moving them up as this market moves up. But still, with this market going vertical up until now, nothing looks better than just going all in. But that's not the end of the story. So yeah, I would just advise people to take a deep breath, talk to us if they want. It's a hard time because you've got the Fed working against you. This whole thing is about psychology and making you feel like you've got to be in.
All right. So a couple of things. One, you mentioned you're 40% long. One of the things that you know, I think you guys at New Harbor are notable for is when you are long, given that you have the skepticism about where prices are today, you oftentimes will match your long positions with some hedges to the downside that basically give you some insurance such that, you know, if you're dancing while the music's playing, if the music suddenly stops and people really panic, you've got some circuit breakers there that will prevent how far your long positions will fall, correct?
Yeah, that's right. And if I could just share the screen very quickly, I'll give you a quick visual on this. So here's the S&P 500 on a daily chart. And here we just hit 4,995.04 today on February 7th. Maybe we'll close above 5,000 today for the first time. So the daily chart shows the activity over the last year or so. When we had this up move and this breakaway gap back here, back in November, October, November, when we broke this downtrend line, we became concerned about the possibility of a blow off top. And I hate to admit it because I don't want to encourage that language. I don't want to encourage people chasing it, but that's what it looked like. Our indicators reversed up, et cetera. So we added to our long positions. We got above 30%. Now we're just about 40% as of today. But as we moved up in this market, we started to move up our hedge. So right now we're about 40% long, but we have a 15% notional put option, which would immediately drop us to 25% in the event of a market crash. Right now, as of today, that hedge is at 4,500 on the S&P. Today or tomorrow or the next day, we're going to move that hedge up to 4,700. And if we move to 52 or 5,300, that hedge will be moved up to 49 or 5. And so the notional value of 40% stocks is there, but it wouldn't take much of a drop, let's say 200 or 300 points, which is a very small amount, 4%, something like that, 4 or 5%. And then boom, automatically we take off the table 15% and go down to 25. The remaining 25% has other hedges on it. And we're focused in sectors that we think have strong relative strength. Things like insurance, industrials, we're adding healthcare, just broke out of a long flat base. Emerging markets we like a lot because of the valuations, but within there, we're in the strongest countries. We just added Japan. We have Brazil, India, and Mexico. And some of those things have run so quickly that we've sold covered calls against them as well. So I can't say that if we had a crash, which we could have at any time, that's the real risk here. I can't say that we wouldn't lose, but we wouldn't lose a lot. Our 40% would immediately go to 25%, and the remaining positions with their covered calls have partial hedges against them as well. And so it's a very buffered situation. There's no way to have your cake and eat it too. You can't just go long the S&P 100% and not feel the pain if we get a crash. We are trying to participate as best we can. We have to accept that we're going to underperform if this market goes vertical more. But our clients essentially want, like I said earlier, to delegate the responsibility to us. They want somebody that's going to match fundamentals with their strategy and somebody that has a plan. And so that's my best answer to what it's like to be a money manager during these times. It isn't easy because a lot of what we're seeing isn't real.
Very helpful answer and very instructive on showing how to play offense and defense at the same time. A lot of retail investors, I find, just tend to play one or the other. They say, I'm going to be offensive, which means I'm going to be long everything, or I'm going to be defensive, which in most cases just means I'm going to be out of the market. You're showing how you can play offense and defense at the same time to make sure that whichever way the market goes, you're not going to be putting yourself at the risk of a catastrophic loss of your client's assets there. All right. Well, look, as we wrap up here, when the markets really start running like this, right? We talked not that long ago about the pull of the big round number of, hey, is this market going to run to 5,000? That's showing us that it clearly looks like it's going to, if not today, probably later this week. And when the animal spirits are running at this level of intensity, FOMO becomes a really real thing, and it can even infect people who started the process saying, nope, I'm just going to be really disciplined, right? And one of the things that I find very helpful about a financial advisor like you guys is it does give a restraint and a reality check to our own emotions as investors. And so I'm curious, Mike, your job is to help people focus on their investing goals. Hey, remember when we sat down, we came up with your plan. These are the things you wanted to do in your life by a certain period of time, and that's what we're helping you, we're creating a plan for you to get there, fund your kids' education, fund your retirement, et cetera. When the animal spirits start running, people just start saying, well, I just want to make more money, right? And they all of a sudden start loosening their risk tolerance and saying, oh, come on, let's stretch for more. Look, everyone's making so much money every day. Are you beginning to see that with the folks that are reaching out to you or any of your clients? Are you beginning to see people hear that siren song of FOMO?
Not really that much yet, to be honest, Adam.
That's good to hear.
It's not really that much yet. Well, it's good to hear, but it's also a little scary because it leads me to believe that we may go off on one final blow off that will knock our socks off here. And maybe that's what we need. Maybe that's exactly what we need to put a point on the largest bubble we've ever lived through that we've ever seen. So, but it's very psychological. Our work with people is I can say personally anyway that my work with people is very psychological. There's that thing about FOMO that you said, it's a very real thing. People feel like, oh, am I an idiot? Did I screw up? Should I have just been in the market this whole time? Look at all my friends, they're making money. I'm not, or I'm not making much. But nobody knows the future, and nobody knows just how much this system was going to change after the great financial crisis, and nobody knows how this will end. We can only guess how this will end, and we can guess where the S&P 500 will touch based on mathematics, but nobody knows the path. And that's the insidious thing here, is this whole wealth effect has been used against us. It's been used as a transmitting mechanism to say that the economy is strong, don't ever doubt the United States, keep believing in the US, et cetera. I certainly believe in the United States. It's been great to me. It's been probably the greatest country that ever was. But I do think that we peaked a long time ago. I think we peaked decades ago. And I think that we're just refusing to look at what we need to do to live within our means. And we're abusing the fact that we've got the world's reserve currency. And we've been doing it for a couple decades now, and it won't end well. Every bubble throughout history, Grant talked a lot about reading history. Every bubble in history ends in collapse. And I think this one will too, as we finish out this fourth turning. I just hope that we can help people through it. I hope it's not too bad. I hope it doesn't escalate into a fighting war. But I hope we all get through it okay. I think that's the most important thing. We'll do our best to help people get through that. I expect that there'll still be markets on the other side of all of this. We hope to help people through it and on the other side. And if we can get through it, the first turning is a wonderful time to be alive. And that's what we hope to do with the insight that we have.
All right. And whether it's the turning from the fourth turning to the first turning, or whether it's just a garden variety recession, I just want to remind folks that recent history shows us, if you look at the past recent recessions we've had, every one was preceded by a pretty aggressive rate hike increase by the Federal Reserve. Then the markets, the Fed paused their rate hikes. The markets then went off to the races, as I like to say with Darius Dale. Right before recessions, that's when partyists get to their craziest, right before the cops show up. We're seeing the markets get pretty crazy right now. It doesn't mean they can't get even crazier from here, but we've had the run-up in rates. We've now had the pause. We're now having the markets take off. According to the historical script, this is playing out to a T. So who knows what's going to happen from here, but if it gets followed by recession, market correction, and the Fed desperately cutting rates, try to catch things back up. Well, that would just be following what history shows us to expect. So we'll keep our eyes on this, obviously, very closely. One of the reasons why this program exists and why I have these financial advisors on every week here to keep us monitoring things on a week-to-week basis. Mike, thanks so much. We'll start wrapping up here. A couple quick housekeeping things for folks. One, as I say every week, highly recommend that the average person watching this works with a good professional financial advisor who understands all the macro issues we talked about here. Grant did a great job of underscoring the key macro issues. Mike did a great job of underscoring the role that the financial advisor plays. If you've got a good one who's doing that for you, great. Stick with them. Give them a call. Maybe say, hey, if you haven't talked to them in a while, hey, can we talk about the plan going forward from here to make sure that you're fully updated on it? But if you don't have one, or if you'd like a second opinion for one that does meet all that criteria, Consider scheduling a free consultation with one of the financial advisors that Thoughtful Money endorses, maybe even Mike and his team there at New Harbor. To do that, just go to thoughtfulmoney.com, fill out the short form there. These consultations are totally free. There's no commitment to work with these guys. It's just a free public service they offer to help as many people position as prudently as possible today. And another reminder that the Thoughtful Money Spring Conference is coming up pretty quickly. It's going to be on Saturday, March 16th. Again, that's online. Ticket sales have actually been doing pretty well because a lot of people are taking me up on my encouragement to register now and lock in the lowest early bird price discount that we're offering here. So to go get that, just go to thoughtfulmoney.com/conference. A reminder, if you're a premium subscriber to our Substack, you get an additional $50 off of that low early bird price discount. And it only costs 15 bucks a month to become a premium subscriber. So if you want to play the arbitrage, pay 15 bucks to save $50, go do it. I want you to get the lowest price. Update two, if you haven't heard already, Rick Rule just signed on to present at the conference. He's always great at these conferences when he comes because he just fully opens the kimono and shares all of the stocks that are on his natural resource stocks watch list. You're going to walk away with dozens and dozens of tickers to go investigate. All right. And then if you enjoyed having Grant on this program, would like to see him come back on the channel as soon as his schedule allows, please let him know that by hitting the like button, then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. All right, Mike, I'm going to give you the last word here. Any parting bits of advice for folks as we head off into the sunset here for a week?
I think I would just mention one thing that Grant said in the talk that we agree with: buy some gold. I didn't mention that in the earlier replies, but 5 to 10% of investable assets, buy some gold. It's sitting here above $2,000 an ounce. It looks like it's going to break out of this, what you would say is maybe a triple or a quadruple top at this point. I do believe that's going to happen. It's hard to make sense of this world where everything feels surreal and it's all about psychology and we don't know what money really is. Buy some real things. Gold and silver makes sense. And Grant talked about reading history and talking to elders. And I think that makes a lot of sense too. But sit back and just kind of wait and see what happens. And we'll make it through this fourth turning. It'll be fine. And I just want to say thank you, Adam, for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity.
No, it's always a pleasure, Mike. Thanks so much, buddy. We'll see you next week. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.
Thank you. See you soon.